Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 39, The Declaration of Independence. Now, before 1776, the word independence was spoken in hushed tones, lest the person speaking it risk being clapped in irons, or worse, the hangman's noose. On the morning of June 7, 1776, Richard Henry Lee will introduce a resolution that these United Colonies are, and of the right ought be, free and independent states. While the Pennsylvania State House erupts, not all the delegates were so eager to declare independence, and the battle will continue over the issue into the evening and also into the next day. While Virginia and New England were colonies that believed that it was inevitable that we would have to choose between going back under the thumb of tyranny by the king or declaring ourselves independent, others, like John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, cautioned against rushing towards independence so recklessly. Now, he wasn't the only one. Delegates from New York, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, and South Carolina, where they had heavy loyalist populations, were also of a mind that, well, we shouldn't just rush into this decision. Now, John Dickinson was from a loyalist family, but he's definitely not a loyalist himself. He's actually known as the penman of the Revolution. He drafted letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania, which actually opposed the Townshend Acts. He is also author of the Olive Branch Petition, which, if you remember back to the Second Continental Congress episode, was the last great attempt by the Congress to seek a peaceful resolution with the Crown before all-out war. Now, Dickinson is a smart man. He actually asked to have the issue tabled until it can be discussed among the individual delegates from each individual colony. If you're going to declare independence, you better make sure that everyone is all in, or else it's just going to be picked apart and thought that the others were pressured into it. And so Dickinson actually has the, I would say, wherewithal and the courage to stand up to those delegates that were screaming for independence and say, wait. Slow down. Let's think about this. And let us give each colony time to discuss it amongst themselves before we go once more into the breach. The vote is postponed for 3 weeks. On June 11th, a five-man committee was appointed. John Adams, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston. It wasn't a guarantee that the Congress was going to vote in favor of independence. But you had to be prepared. And you had to be prepared with a document that would outline the legal and moral justification for independence. So who would get the burden of writing this document? Well, it's going to fall to the young representative from Virginia, Thomas Jefferson. Adams spoke of him saying that he had a gift of composition. Jefferson is born on April 13, 1743. He is born into one of the most prominent families in all of Virginia. He begins his education at the age of 9 at a local private school. In 1760, Jefferson will attend the College of William and Mary. After 3 years of study, he will choose to study law. Now, law schools are not set up the same way they are today. You don't go to college at, let's say, Duke, and then you're just going to go to Columbia Law School. There's no such thing. So if you were going to study law in the colonies, instead, after you finish your education, you would read the law under the supervision of an established lawyer. Jefferson would study under George Wythe, one of the most respected lawyers in all of Virginia. And though he studies with him for 5 years, which was about double the average amount of time, by the time he takes the bar in 1767, he was one of the most learned lawyers in all of the colony. He practices law in Virginia till 1774. Being of the landed gentry, he's also elected to the House of Burgess in 1768. It's while he's at the House of Burgess that Jefferson kind of falls into the more radical bloc, led by Patrick Henry and George Washington. It's actually in 1774 that he pens his first major political work, A Summary View of the Rights of British America. Now, it's in this political work that he talks about how the colonies are subjects of the British Empire, but they are not subject to the British Parliament. Now, what the heck does that mean? Well, in his view, America was, or at least the colonies themselves, I should say, were founded by the crown, funded by the crown. The people who were sent here, for the most part, were sent by the crown. So those ancestors of men who came here, well, they were, should swear fealty to the crown. But by no right does the British Parliament, who for the most part has never been here, knows nothing of what it's like to live in America, and thus how to govern Americans, should be subject to the British Parliament. And that's the divide. Yes, we will hang pictures and paintings of the king in our taverns and our homes, and we'll say, God save the Queen, and we will, you know, give huzzas to all things British. But then you turn around and tell us that, well, we're going to charge you for things like stamps and tea and all that. You clearly know nothing about what it's like to live in America with Americans. So you have no right to govern Americans. We are strong enough to create our own governments, and we have our own local governments that will tell us what and how we should be run. And they will represent the colonists' interests. It establishes him as probably one of the most eloquent writers of the time, especially in the colony itself. And it's no surprise that a year later, in 1775, he's invited to the Second Continental Congress. He will replace Peyton Randolph. Peyton Randolph will return to the House of Burgess, but he actually passes away later that year. So in June 1776, Congress asked him to write one of the most important documents in the history of America, and Jefferson is up to the task. He'll sit in seclusion in a rented apartment in Philadelphia, writing draft after draft. Now, you can go to Philadelphia today and actually visit a site called the Declaration House. If you're looking at Independence Hall, if you just go down that block to the right-hand side, you'll come across a brick building. It's maybe one block away. Has a little sign out front that says Declaration House. It is a recreation by the National Park Service of that same apartment that Jefferson stayed in for 3 weeks in 1776, writing the Declaration of Independence. Now, the original apartment was lost to time and history. But for the bicentennial, the National Park Service had created, from everything, all the documents that we had, just from Jefferson and from others that visited him there, a best guess recreation of what his apartment would have looked like. So you walk up to the second floor of this building, and all that's in there is a one-bedroom apartment. A modest living space. It's got some features that you would expect from a Virginia planter, a rather wealthy Virginia planter. But you just look and you just see it's just a bed, a dresser, some travel cases, and a desk. And for 17 days, Thomas Jefferson sat writing draft after draft. Now, Adams and Franklin, through all of this, are offering what helpful suggestions that they can. But this really falls to Thomas Jefferson. And once he's completed his, we'll call it our first draft of the Declaration, it is brought to the Congress on June 28th. It's read aloud to the Congress. Then it is simply taken and placed on a table so that the representatives could review it at their leisure. It won't be discussed until Monday, July 1st, and for 9 hours, the delegates will argue over the issues. They are taking everything apart, the wording, the structure, how it sounds. Some representatives, like John Dickinson, are still seeking moderation, while others, like John Adams, believe that independence is the only way and we have to be hard on this issue. The one thing that both sides agree on is that it must be unanimous. Everyone must agree. South Carolina is not ready to vote. And they take what I feel is a brave stance, and they want to hold the vote for just one more day so that they can further discuss with each other what is going to be best for South Carolina. Congress gladly grants them this. And the next day, on July 2nd, South Carolina will join with her sister colonies, and they will vote for independence. Now, some were very eager. Yes, independence. We want it. We've been feeling it. We need it. Others did so with a heavy heart. And then there was another group, like John Dickinson, who will abstain from voting altogether. They won't vote against it because they don't want it to be on record that, well, we voted against it. They want it to still seem unanimous, but they are voting, or they're choosing not to vote. And Dickinson abstains mainly because he wanted his delegation from Pennsylvania to vote how they felt, and to make it so that he didn't, in a sense, sway the votes of those who look up to the elder statesmen. But with a positive vote for independence laid down, the Congress will spend the day of July 3rd arguing over the wording of the Declaration. The wording was important. The wording had to sound like they were free-born men with the right to self-governance, not British subjects that were trying to legalize a rebellion. So for almost 12 hours, the Congress will argue over how and the correct way they should present their case for independence. So the following day, July 4th, Congress reconvenes, approves the declaration and its changes. John Hancock, who's the president of the Congress, and his secretary, Charles Thompson, immediately sign the handwritten draft before it's sent to the printer. It's dated July 4th. John Hancock's signature is always the most noticeable on the document, and he has been quoted as saying, "There, I guess King George will be able to read it without his spectacles." Hundreds of copies are printed and sent throughout the colonies, to cities, towns, continental camps. Washington even lined up his troops on July 8th while they were in New York and had it read to each individual regiment. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which connect them with one another and to assume among the powers of earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and the natures of God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The excitement for the Declaration was celebrated with fireworks, bonfires, ringing of church bells, and in some cases more riotous behavior. For example, New York patriots were so excited that they pulled down a gilded lead statue of King George III. The statue was subsequently melted down into 42,000 musket balls. In Philadelphia, the Royal Arms was removed from the State House, albeit probably through some more extra legal practices. Basically, someone came in the night and stole the coat of arms right off the State House. But it made for a pretty good war plunder, so. A copy, of course, makes its way across the ocean, and when the king reads it, he was, and I'm using air quotes on here, hurt and annoyed. The historian Edward Gibbon confided in a friend that the Americans have now crossed the Rubicon. With the unanimous agreement of the Congress and the public enthusiasm so high, the Declaration of Independence is officially signed on August 2nd, 1776. Now, for those scratching their heads, why is it officially signed on August 2nd? It's because, remember, the copy that is running around the colonies is unofficial. The changes haven't been fully made, and you're going to have a more clean-cut copy. You don't write a book report and leave all the places where you fix punctuation or cross things out and we're writing things in the margin. That you don't want to, you know, present as our official Declaration of Independence. So a new one is written out and printed up, and most of the 56 signers will place their signature on a document that, well, if the British won, would have earned them a one-way trip to the gallows. I say most, that's because five delegates, Eldridge Gerry, Oliver Wolcott, Lewis Morris, Thomas McKean, and Matthew Thornton, will sign later. In some cases, 5 years later. As for those that didn't sign, which was about seven men, I want to stress that these are not Tory men. They are men that are not excited about going to war with Britain. John Dickinson, for example, he feels that we should have an article of confederation, we should secure foreign recognition, then we declare independence. There is actually one man, and this is a very interesting fact, that Richard Stockton of New Jersey is the only delegate that actually recants his decision to sign the Declaration of Independence. He's captured by the British in November 1776, is basically tortured into recanting his signature and declaring allegiance to the king. He spends the next year in jail, but when he gains his freedom in December of 1777, he takes a new oath, this time to the state of New Jersey. Now, the Declaration of Independence is probably the second most important document in American history behind, of course, our own Constitution. Both of these documents are on display in the Rotunda of the National Archives, but did you know that there are actually 26 surviving copies? These are the Dunlap broadsides. These are the copies that are printed on the night of July 4th, and they're sent all over the colonies. There are some crazy stories about where people are finding these broadsides. There was one guy who found it in an old desk. Another person found it behind a painting. So next time you're hanging around an old garage sale and you find something from the 1770 region in a place that was known to have a copy of the Declaration, you might just want to check the drawers or check behind the frame, because if you find one of these Dunlap broadsides, you have placed your hands on what is truly a national treasure. And that's going to do it for this episode. I took a more adventurous look at the Declaration of Independence. Instead of sitting there and talking about all the versions that Thomas Jefferson went through and the arguments over the wording just between him and Adams and Franklin, I just wanted to give you the facts. And though I could probably spend six episodes talking about the Declaration of Independence, you know how I feel about beating dead horses. I didn't want to spend all this time talking about what we already know. This document was of vital importance. 56 men signed it. The king got a copy, probably tore it out or used it to wipe up a mess that, well, we'll just leave it at that. And it became probably one of the singular most important documents in world history as well as American history. Many a country has modeled their wording of constitutions off of our own Declaration of Independence and our own Constitution. So though I would love to spend many episodes talking about it, I just wanted to take this time and just talk about it in probably the most simplistic and adventurous way I can. Because it really is an adventure, seeing that there were 56 men instead of 72 men that want to sign this document, how negotiations have to be made, how many times colonies have to look within themselves as to what is best for us. That's the approach I wanted to take. So as for our recommendations this week, I chose two. I felt that since we were talking about the Declaration of Independence and its author is probably one of the most important men in American history, I thought I would choose two biographies of Thomas Jefferson. The first is actually probably the gold standard for how to look at and study what's going on for the Declaration of Independence, because it's Thomas Jefferson's autobiography. It's his story written by him, and basically you already know what the author is thinking because, well, he went through all of it. The next is probably one of the more better known biographies on Jefferson, and that's American Sphinx, the character of Thomas Jefferson by Joseph J. Ellis. One that's on the list of things I want to read, but I haven't gotten there yet. But I, you know me, I always take suggestions from guys I've worked with in the Park Service or those I work with in the 1st Delaware Regiment. And this one has been passed down from one of my mentors as probably one of the more well-known Jefferson biographies that is out there. So that'll do it for this week. Next week we're about to beat the drums of war once again, as we head up to New York City and we reacquaint ourselves with the main army under George Washington. So till then, everyone have a good week, and as always, keep the powder dry.